Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is a call-in show today, and our topic is understanding the basic principles of how free people and free markets grow or are lost with Dr. Paul Cleveland. So please call us with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. Again, that's 1-800-313-9443. Folks, today we're going to have a fascinating show. First, I'd like to say hello to our special commentator, Ms. Zoe Russell. Hello, Zoe.
Hello.
Welcome. So next, I would like to welcome our guest this week, Dr. Paul Cleveland. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you very much for joining us. Folks, Dr. Cleveland is a professor of economics at Birmingham Southern College in Birmingham, Alabama. Paul's written an excellent book called Understanding the Sacred Lies, Unmasking the Sacred Lies, which gives an excellent historical understanding of how America has arrived here in its current condition. In fact, I think the subtitle of his book should be Telling the Stories of America's True Economic History. Now, his book was written, I believe, because I think you mentioned in one of your other writings there, Paul, because so many of your new students were coming into your classes with so many myths that they first had to unlearn. Is that so?
Right. Absolutely correct. And, you know, and just they're almost ignorant of history, of American history and as it really was, and or they've bought into something that, you know, an explanation of the facts that couldn't possibly be true if you think about economic principles.
Well, you know, we all grew up with these sacred lies, as you put it, you know, which has caused us to become, I think, little by little less and less free. So, you know, folks, I would love to have you all read his excellent book, Unmasking the Sacred Lies, which, by the way, we are featuring on our website at radiofreemarket.com. But since we cannot read the whole book on the show with you today, Paul, we're going to start by establishing a few of the foundational principles that you bring out in your book. So, you know, let's start here. I loved how in a few pages you very simply laid out what I call foundational American principles. So first let's talk about the difference between freedom and liberty as not being licensed to do whatever one has the impulse to do. Would you explain that to us?
Yeah, I think that's one thing that is really important. You know, everyone believes in freedom and liberty when you put it out like that, but what do we mean by those terms? A lot of people think that they means that they ought to be able to do whatever they want, even if it turns out badly that somebody else should have to pay for the consequences of their poor behavior. And of course, that's not at all what the founders conceived of as freedom and liberty. I mean, in their view, you were free, but you were responsible to bear the burden of the consequences of your own actions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really important to think about in those terms. If we boil it down from there are only certain human rights, the right to life, liberty, and property. But there would be no rights, you know, such as Franklin Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights with, you know, the right to a job or the right to education or the right to health care. None of these things could be a right because they can't be universally established for everyone. And government can't, you know, it's not divine who can, being who can call something into existence that didn't exist beforehand. So
right.
Unless you believe in fairies, you know, the tooth fairy or something, you're gonna reject that kind of point of view.
Well, this is a great start. Unfortunately, we have a break right now, and we're going to come back in just a minute. And, folks, when we come back, we're going to have Dr. Paul Cleveland, and we're going to be talking more and more about these foundational principles of free people and free markets. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Michael McKay, and with me is Zoe Russell, our special commentator, and our special guest today, Dr. Paul Cleveland. So, Paul, you were just going in and talking about the differences between freedom and liberty. And, you know, the popular notion of freedom and liberty is that we can do whatever we want without enduring the consequences of our behavior. What's wrong with that notion?
Well, the problem with that is that somebody is going to bear the consequence of poor action. And Frederick Bastiat, in his book, Economic Harmonies, pointed out that, you know, if it's the person who's acting who bears responsibility for poor action, then they have enough motive to change behavior and to adjust what they're doing. However, if I can shift the consequences of my own actions to somebody else, then I can pursue it with impunity over the long term, or at least conceivably so for a while. Now, it always has detrimental effects in society that eventually catch up with you, you know, and that's, we've been on this path. We've slowly been allowing people to shift onto taxpayers the burdens of their poor choices in life and or their mismanagement of property and that sort of thing. In the most recent example, the banking bailouts, well, why shouldn't the businesses fail? I mean, what's too big to fail? If they've made poor choices, they ought to live with their poor choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. Well, you know, one of the things that was very fascinating to me in your book is how you connected this this notion of people trying to escape the consequences of their behavior with both the welfare and the warfare state. Could you explain how these are connected?
Oh, sure. Well, as you know, as we've moved away, as government has begun to shift itself away from its primary duty, namely the protection of each individual's life, liberty, and property, and as it's become, you know, part of the welfare side of it, was they're going to the government's going to take care of everybody, or this sort of utopian vision that the progressive movement and various socialists had, called various collectivists, that somehow the government can provide, you know, or redistribute the property from one person to another and do so effectively. Well, one, it just won't work. You know, it's built upon the presumption that people continue to do that, which you know, they have no incentive to do eventually. And so that's the welfare side of it. And, of course, the warfare side of it, once you go down that, you're really pitting people against one another. And if we do it internationally, we're pitting one nation against another nation, and we're promoting, you know, worldwide instability in that sense.
You know, you make the point that the average person is actually made a slave of the political elites. And I think a lot of people feel that way. They feel very frustrated that, you know, no matter what is happening, I mean, I think it's pretty pervasive that most Americans feel that these bailouts are pretty stupid. They recognize
right.
that they are actually holding the bag, that they're passing it forward to their children. And
right.
And yet they feel rather helpless. You know, in this kind of political hostage situation that they are.
Right. This has all happened very slowly. You know, it was the progressive movement. They embraced the kind of socialism of Karl Marx, but they wanted to bring it about in this sort of gradual method. You know, an evolutionary means of achieving the end. And and so they played upon probably the worst passions in the human heart, which are, you know, obvious to us all, jealousy, envy, and greed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you looked at the original income tax, well, the first rate was 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And now if we'd adjusted that for inflation, if that code were still in place, well, if you were a single individual, you wouldn't even pay income tax at all if you made less than something like $55,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a married couple, you wouldn't pay any income tax if you made less than $75,000. And then you would only pay 1% for taxable income from that point up to the next $350,000. So most people thought, well, this isn't really going to apply to me. It's only those rich people out there that are going to pay.
Right.
And, you know, and so you can really play upon that, upon people's kind of natural greed and jealousy and envy of others. You know, if there's successful businessmen like Ford or Rockefeller or these sorts of individuals, you know, people felt, oh, okay, well, it's okay to go take it from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're not going to take that much because the top marginal rate at the time was only 7% initially, but it quickly adjusted up. Now, later, after World War I, with Woodrow Wilson, who was, you know, really attacked private property fairly ruthlessly.
Let's go back a minute. You know, one of the things I really liked is that you set up some basic stepping stone understandings for the establishment of private property.
Okay.
And
yeah.
You mentioned that there are only a few ways that people can obtain what they want. Make it for themselves, trade for it. Using something to trade that they have or that they make, receive it as a gift, or stealing it, you know, from others. And so that's the fourth one, stealing it from others. Is it possible? I mean, economically, it's impossible for everyone to steal from everyone else.
Oh, exactly. As a matter of fact, when I teach my principles classes, I'll kind of lay those out and point out that really only the first two are economic. In other words, only production and trade are economic. But the other two, charity and theft, are not economic because they cannot be generalized. And you're quite right. You know, as long as I'm the only thief out there and everybody else is out busy producing stuff, and, you know, I can go let myself into their homes and pilfer what I want. But if everyone tries to do it and nobody produces anything, then there's nothing to steal, and we all starve to death.
Mm-hmm.
It's why socialism always fails, because socialism is nothing but a system of organized theft orchestrated by government. And so it can never work. You know, it eventually always fails because it's enticing people to play a game that's an unwinnable game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, charity likewise requires prior production before you can give anything away. You have to have something to give.
Right. And if you need producers, you therefore need savers.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Is precisely the point. And so, you know, from that point on, what I'll do is I'll hold my students' feet to the fire, because I'll say, you know, if we want to talk economics, then we're talking production and trade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to talk about theft, you know, we can deal with that too, and show the effects of it every time out.
Mm. Well, you make the point that we need private property rights, but are these natural, or do they occur only because governments provide them to us?
Well, property itself is generated naturally. I mean, if you think about it for a moment, if we go back in history, you know, people are physical creatures. We need to eat. We need to drink water. We need shelter and clothing, these sorts of things. Well, we have to produce. I mean, there's no other way to get it. You know, there are things out there in the world that we can co-opt and we can use. You know, if I go out and I'm hungry and pick berries off a bush, well, they're my berries. They become my property. Or if I cultivate a blackberry bush, it becomes my bush because I'm the one raising it, tending it, bringing it to fruition for a purpose that I have in mind. So property is something that we naturally create. And, you know, if you think about it, as we progress, we're not going to progress well if we just try to produce everything we want for ourselves. We do better when we specialize and trade with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And we can accomplish so much more that way, that's why we do it. But there are always people who want to do the shortcut and just take it, what they want, from somebody else by force or fraud. So law you know, the need for law came about because people have been so willing throughout human history to violate the property of others.
Mm-hmm.
So, that is kind of a central theme in my book and in
my work. Yeah, it is. It's an essential basic point. Also, you know, explain this basic need to trade you just mentioned. Why private property? Why is private property fundamental to the economic success?
Well, you can't, you can't trade what you don't possess, but, you know, so private property, I just think, is part of our nature. It's who we are. And it's what we create when we interact with the world in order to survive. And it's why John Locke wrapped it up with the other two, the right to life and the right to liberty, coexist with the right to property. They're intertwined. You can't drop one without dropping the other two. So they exist as a whole fabric, you know, and not really separate at all. And it would be an illusion to think that property could be held in common somehow. It certainly can't be used in common. I remember they got some communal bicycles at Birmingham Southern, and that lasted for about 3 weeks before they began to disappear.
Okay, we're going to come back to that point right after the break. I'm sorry I have to interrupt you right now, Paul, but we're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we'll be back in just a minute. Talk to you in just a minute. Thank you very much for listening. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. Zoe, I'm turning it over to you. Go ahead.
All right. Dr. Cleveland, can you tell us more about where you were cut off, why communal property tends to break down?
Sure. Think of it for a moment. If you're trying to hold something communally, well, you certainly can't use it communally. I was using the example, this was about a year or so ago, the college acquired, it was like 100 bicycles to use communally. Well, the problem is if nobody owns it, nobody has any interest in taking care of it. And so students would do things like this. You couldn't know that the bike you rode to class would still be there after you got out of class. So one of the things that students did is they would take the seats off and take them into class with them. Or they'd ride them all, you know, they would ride them downhill, but nobody would want to ride them back uphill, so all the bikes would collect downhill and at the bottom of a hill somewhere and just sit there. And, of course, they were all left out in the rain. And I think one young man was expelled from the college for co-opting ownership to the bikes and reselling them in the open market. So
did he get a job at the Federal Reserve, do you think?
That's right. maybe he's being groomed for that. We don't know. So. But anyway, the few remaining bikes we just watched rust away within like 6 months, and I haven't seen one in well over a year now, so I think they're all have vanished permanently from the college scene. It doesn't work that way. You know, only one person can use property, and so when we have ownership of it, we'll take care of it, and we have an incentive to. You know, moreover...
Please go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, actually, I was going to bridge to another point you were just saying,
okay.
Moreover. Okay. I'm sorry I interrupted you on that. I wanted to go into yet another point here about how not only is it the private property that we all have, but the diversity that we bring to the table that creates the big opportunity of an economy.
Certainly is true. I mean, you know, one of the things I do with my students is I'll pick out a student and ask them if, you know, if it's after lunch, I'll say, well, did you have lunch today? And they'll say, well, yeah. So I'll say, well, what'd you have? And they'll say, well, I had a Subway sandwich or something to that effect. And so, you know, then I'll say, okay, now, if you had to produce that sandwich yourself without any help whatsoever from anyone else, how long would it take you? And when I force the issue, I say, well, you know, do you know what bread is, how to make bread? You know what it comes from? you know, you're going to have to go grow wheat, mill it into flour, bake the bread, and all of these.
To mill it into flour.
Yeah, I mean, you'll have to do all these things yourself before you know, to get a sandwich. And so once I get them to think that way, I say, okay, now how long would it take you to make one? And, it would be years and years worth of labor to get it. You would starve to death first.
Right.
And then I'll say, okay, now, but you went and bought that, right? And I said, well, how much did you pay? Well, $5. And I'll ask them if they have a job, which most of them have had a job or, you know, making at least around $10 an hour. And so I'll point out, really, for half an hour's worth of labor, you were able to get that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means that trade allows you to live far better than you'd ever live otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a miracle that you compensated everybody and literally thousands and thousands of people and their labor were involved in the production of that sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the ingredients that went into it. And for $5, you compensated everybody, and they did it voluntarily. They didn't even have to know you. Or they didn't have to really care for you or anything else, but they had to serve your interests. And so, really, when you think about it, when we look around at ourselves, when we find out, well, we're unique, we're different, we have different talents and different abilities and skills, and when we concentrate our time and our use in what we're really good at, and we trade amongst ourselves, we live so much better than we ever would otherwise. And if we'll only focus on that, on production and trade, then we'll all be better off. We'll make ourselves better off, and we'll be creating wealth steadily in time instead of trying to rely on theft and trying to use government as our instrument of taking what we want from somebody else.
You say that what complicates the entire trading process is the invention of money. How does it complicate the trading process?
Well, it takes people's focus off of what's really going on, because what money is just a means of exchange. It's a means by which we indirectly trade with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, once again, here's the thing with my students that I'll do. I'll point out barter is very difficult sometimes. You know, and I have them imagine, what if I'm going to go to the grocery store this weekend to try to get groceries, and I go in and I find the store manager, and I'll say to him, well, sir or ma'am, I'll gladly lecture you today about economic principles for a certain quantity of food. Well, that may be a tough sell, because they would have to really be interested in the economic principles at this point, and they may or may not be. And I'd have to, we'd have to have a double coincidence of want.
Well, we're gonna interrupt you right here on this term, double coincidence of wants. We want to come back to that right after the break. Unfortunately, we're flying through this show here. I want to cover so much more territory with you. This is Radio Free Market. You're listening to Dr. Paul Cleveland, and we'll be right back right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and we're talking with Dr. Paul Cleveland today on understanding the basic principles of how free people, free markets grow or are lost. We were just talking about barter and how primitive that is, and you were making a point on that, Paul. Please go ahead.
Sure. The point I was making is if I had to rely on bartering with everyone for the things that I wanted in life, it would be a hard sell. I can, you know, I was imagining going to the grocery store and trying to offer econ lectures to the store manager in exchange for groceries. Or you can imagine how many courses in economics I might have to do to get an automobile exchange. And then they would really have to want to know, and they might not. But I didn't have to do it that way, because what money allows us to do is that it allows us to enter into more complex contracts. Now, I just entered into a contract with Birmingham Southern College. They wanted economics courses taught. I'm qualified to teach it. We agreed on an amount of money to be exchanged for the service rendered. And, you know, and I've noticed that the grocer and the car dealer are gladly willing to take my money in exchange for those things that I want. So money is just this medium by which we exchange with one another, and we indirectly trade goods for goods rather than directly trade them.
So money actually expands our ability to trade in the first place, since the double coincidence of wants severely limits wider trading to take place.
Exactly.
So what about natural barriers to trade that we must overcome? You know, I noticed that you have several that you discuss in your book.
Right. Well, we all face the barrier of distance that we've got to overcome, and so I've got to either transport the good from whoever makes it to myself, or transport myself to get the good, or to procure the service, whichever the case may be. And so transportation costs are an inherent part of the cost of trade, and, as well as information. I've got to be aware that somebody is out there and has something that I want, and that they might want what I have, and that we can engage in a trade, you know, that we can exchange. And so there's costs associated with gathering up information. And then finally, we've got to be able to communicate with one another. So all of these are costs we face. And then what's been happening over time is these costs have been coming down. In fact, really rather dramatically, they've been dropping.
Well, you know, I mentioned to Zoe recently, I think I may have even mentioned it on air recently, that I went to a grocery store up in Iowa City a few weeks back, and I bought some fresh perch fillets from Lake Victoria in Central Africa. And they had been deeply frozen and flown to the center of Iowa, you know, in a couple of days, at a profit to all of the people who handled it, and ultimately on our, served in our kitchen. It's an astounding situation. So as you were saying, these natural barriers to trade of information, transportation, and communication are shrinking rather dramatically.
And so the ability to trade really worldwide has just been exploding in recent years. Here's an example I use in class. I guess it was October of 2008, went to Chengdu, China, to lecture in a number of universities there. And I asked the students, I said, well, now imagine the year was 1900 instead of 2008. How long would it have taken me to get from Birmingham, Alabama to Chengdu, China?
Mm-hmm.
And, you go by train, cross country, you know, to San Francisco. And, of course, trains at that date and time, I think the average speed was around 35 miles an hour. So you can imagine how long it would take to get to California.
Mm-hmm.
And then get on a boat, and we've got to cross a steamboat and cross the Pacific, maybe do port in a city like Shanghai, and then I've got to go inland. We, of course, 2008 didn't do it that way at all. I got on a plane, flew to Atlanta, walked across the terminal, got into another waiting area. After a while, boarded another plane, flew to Seoul, South Korea, waited there for a while, boarded another plane, and flew into Chengdu. I think the elapsed time was around 24, 25 hours.
An amazing reduction in time from months.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk about a miracle. Yeah.
Yeah. The costs have just gone way down.
You know, you use in the book this example of what a breakthrough it was when Vasco da Gama discovered the water route to Asia from Europe.
Exactly. And, you know, Henry the Navigator actually founded that school and Portugal with this thought in mind. You know, if we can find an all-water route, if we can find a way through Africa, you know, we'll be able to move the trade from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic where they were. And so, you know, he was able to get students, maritime students, into school, and their task of learning to sail would be sailing down the coast of Africa, looking for a way through Africa. And so Degan was actually one of these students, and who actually made it all the way, came back, and it was reported that the spice load that he brought back paid for the trip 60-fold over, so $60 for every $1 invested in cost.
Wow, know, amazing.
On the trip. So really just an amazing difference there. I've been looking for that kind of investment myself for a good time now, without much luck.
So in addition to these natural barriers, or maybe actually within them, of transportation, communications, and information, merchants have always had to deal with numerous other problems in addition to distances like weather, harsh seas and terrain,
sure,
and, of course, those who would rather make a living by merely taking from others what they wanted.
That's right. So, paying for security has always been with us as well. I mean, we'd all be much better off if we didn't pursue that sort of approach to try to make our way in this world. But that's not likely to change. If human history teaches us anything, you've got to be on your toes and ever aware of your surroundings in that sort of situation, because there are always going to be people out there who want to make their living by theft.
Well, there's the soft theft of trying to get other people to agree to take from you and as a condition of you living together,
Right.
Which is the redistributive statist, collectivist state, if you will. And then, of course, there's the more direct approach. And we've always needed to be able to defend ourselves, and probably always will need to do so. You make the point that by establishing government as having the monopoly power of coercive force, abuse by governments on their people has, of course, as we all know, occurred. But governments were supposed to prevent this.
Sure, that's their purpose. And the founders, that was what they were aiming for, trying to come up with a means, recognizing the problem that we all face, the issue of security in life, but also they recognize the danger. The danger is always there that governments, because they're institutions of force, that force can be abused. And rather than protecting the citizenry, it can actually violate the citizenry. And so the whole structure of checks and balances was aimed at the limitation of government to keep it in its proper bounds.
Has there ever been a successful experiment yet where political power has been limited to its appropriate realm?
Well, I would say from my study of history, in the course of human history, the American experiment has come closest, never ideal, never perfect, but certainly in the context of human history, the ideals were clearly articulated,
mm-hmm,
even if they weren't practiced to perfection. And in fact, it's hard to imagine that it could be practiced to perfection.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there's really no golden age time, if you will, but there is better and worse. And I think you see that, the way when they're talking about setting up the government, in the preamble is, in order to form a more perfect union.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of odd language. After all, what's more perfect than perfect?
Mm-hmm.
You can get more perfect than perfect. And but I think what they were getting at was just this. They didn't think they were going to get perfection, but they thought they could move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. So please give us some lesser-known examples, if you have them, Andy, of some people trying to live off others by privilege or by force.
The Soviet Union was, sort of the classic example. I mean, the jokes abound among the people there. One of the popular jokes among the people were, well, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us.
Right.
You know, and, another joke, this was from Romania. Guy finally saves enough money to buy an automobile, so he goes down to the car dealership and he says, well, I finally saved enough money, I'd like to buy an automobile. And the dealer laughs and says, well, come back in 12 years and you can pick it up. And the man says, well, should I come in the morning or the afternoon? And the dealer laughs again and he says, what does it matter? It's 12 years. And he says, well, yes, yes, I know, but I have a dental appointment that day too. You know, these sort of examples are very telling, because what they reveal is this, that the rulers in those places were living like leeches and parasites off the populace. And, basically sucking them dry over time. And, of course, this sort of elitism is common throughout the world. And unfortunately, it's the direction that we're heading in America as well.
So let's switch gears here for a minute. So far we've been talking about the importance of private property, production, and trade. Let's start talking about the nature of human action and what this teaches us. You know, by the way, folks, this next section is going to introduce to you all the all-important work of Ludwig von Mises, who actually wrote the book Human Action. So let's start with the basics. Humans act. What more does this teach us?
Well, I think what it teaches us is this. It's something about who we are. And I like the way that Mises begins his book. He begins talking about us in this particular way. We are all self-aware, conscious of who we are, conscious of our purposes, and that we have ends, and we're volitional creatures who are aiming to accomplish our ends. And
would you explain this word volitional?
Yeah, volition just means we have our will. We will to accomplish the ends that we desire. And so there's a self-determination to all of us that my purposes in life are not your purposes, Michael, or Zoe's purposes, but we each have our own. And really, because we're structured that way, and we're also social, in fact, the differences between us allow for that socialization between ourselves and the interaction that we need to really best accomplish our ends. And so what economics is all about is this cooperative approach to the accomplishment of our ends.
So we think, we plan, we act. Do we act randomly, or do we act with a purpose?
No, we act with purpose. It's not random at all. We're always aiming to achieve our purpose. In fact, we'll never act in ways that we don't think will achieve the purpose. And Yuri Maltsev tells a really nice story here of a young man, and this was during the 1980s, in the period of Gorbachev and Glasnost and Perestroika. And, it was the new freedoms. And so this young man was really excited about the new freedoms and set out a plan. His plan was he went out and purchased a baby pig, and he was going to raise this pig to fruition. Well, the day had arrived, the pig was ready to be slaughtered and the meat sold in the market, so he slaughtered the pig and set off for the market. And, Yuri says, you've never seen a young man more excited than this young man as he set off to go sell his pig and to make a profit on it. And he said, but that evening he was walking down the street, and this same young man was up under a street lamp drunk with a bottle of vodka by his side. He knew he wasn't given to that kind of behavior, so he went up and he asked. He says, what are you doing here? Why are you drunk at this time of the evening? And the young man looked up at Yuri and he said, well, it really didn't go so well today. He said, the first thing that had happened when I got to the market is I ran to the health inspector and he took a third of the pig and he took the best parts. After that, I had to bribe a couple of the police officers even to get into the market, and of course they took the best of what was left. And after I'd paid fees and paid rent for a slot in the market to sell what I had left, all I had was enough to sell to make money enough to buy this bottle of vodka, and it's just about gone. And so right there, you know this young man's not ever going to do it again.
Right.
He's not going to raise another pig. So production just ceases. You know, incentives do matter.
Right. So we're going to come back to that topic in a broader sense at another time, because you're touching on a number of things that I would love to expand on, but we're going to run out of time. And I wanted to ask you to build on this idea of, you know, that we act with a purpose, but you also mentioned that only individuals act, that there isn't such thing as a collective. Can you explain that?
Well, yeah, we might act in unison together, but we do so by, you know, forming an association or a group. But the group always is made up of the individuals who join the group. It's not ever, the group doesn't have an existence of its own apart from the membership, apart from the individual people who make up the group. And so action always at a root level goes back to the individual. And Mises referred to that as, you know, economics is radically methodologically individualist.
Okay. Well, I want to establish these points a little bit more. We're going to have to wait for just another minute. We're going to take a brief break, folks, and then we'll be back talking with Dr. Paul Cleveland. And this is Radio Free Markets. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and I have Dr. Paul Cleveland and Zoe Russell with us today. And we were just talking about these basics of human action, Paul, and you were laying these out so nicely that only individuals act, and you were saying that there's no such thing as a collective, and we only act toward desired results. But we also must choose to act from among competing options, because we can't do everything. You know, why is that?
Well, I don't think we have really many other choices. I mean, our self-awareness of ourselves and our self-determination lead to this point. You know, there are some people in the academy who are trying to reduce human action down to the level of the animal and down to herd mentality. But the problem with that is their theory makes no sense, because they conceive of themselves as being able to rise above the herd and to lead the herd.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if all people were in the herd, aren't they in the herd?
Mm-hmm.
But if they were in the herd, how did they rise above the herd to be able to know it better than anybody else? You know, that's an irrational position to take.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a problem in the academy today, because it's taken the academy in this direction of postmodernism that has thrown logic out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And has reduced it down to, you know, this sort of this mindless game of, well, whatever feels good. And that's not where, that's not suitable for creatures who are intelligent and who have minds, and we can think and reason and understand the world in which we live.
Zoe, during the break, you made a point. You want to ask that or make your point?
So is that why a lot of other economic schools of thought tend to focus on math and models instead of human action?
Oh, absolutely, because if you think about it, utilitarianism is of that sort. It reduces human action down to the level of being nothing but a calculation. One of the things... And this really bothered me early in when I was in graduate school at Texas A&M. I worked for an experimental economist, and anyway, it was my job to work with his test subjects, which were rats in Skinner boxes. And now we showed, or he showed, that rats are pretty good utility maximizers, according to utility theory. And And that kind of bothered me for a long time, but then I finally figured it out. Well, yeah, what else would they be? They're animals. That's the way animals behave. The only problem is people aren't animals in that sense. We rise above the animal world in our self-consciousness and in the way in which we interact with the world in ways rats never would. You know, because if I left the doors to the Skinner boxes open, those rats would never engage in any kind of trading relationships.
Right. We can conceive of additional choices.
Right. And in ways that they can never do. And so really that kind of reductionism is a bit of a problem in the for some economists, I think.
Well, folks, we're going to have to wrap this up today. I want to thank Dr. Paul Cleveland and our special commentator, Zoe Russell, for being with us and talking about these basic principles of how free people and free markets grow or are lost. We are going to continue the show at a later date, and we'll get Dr. Paul on the show with us again. Until that time, please listen to us again. We'll be on next week. And so until that time, you can visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com. This is Michael McKay, and I want to thank you all for listening. Thank you, and good day.